First, the U.S. and China are tied together by international trade. China is the top source of imports to the United States, and it's the third biggest market for products from the United States, behind Canada and Mexico, and for products from Wisconsin. In American politics, there have been concerns about a trade deficit with China, and more recently, international political rivalry has raised security fears about dependence on China, from machinery to computer chips to social media. But untangling those business connections could be way easier said than done. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. Economic connections with China? Do you buy or avoid materials marked with that Made in China label? Does that matter to you at all? What questions do you have about the economic connections between the often political rivals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if your business relies on selling stuff to China or buying stuff from China, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Zoe Liu is Fellow for International Political Economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Zoe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you very much for having me.
I spelled out some of the basics there. Can you talk a little bit more about how interconnected the American economy is with the Chinese economy?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you've already gave us a very good and a very solid overview in terms of the trade relationship between the two countries, right? And indeed, exactly as you said, despite the trade war since the Trump administration's especially escalating starting from 2018, China and the U.S. trade is still very much tied together. And by 2021, China was the largest trading partner of the United States, and by a lot of measures, trading with China actually have created more than 2 million jobs on a yearly basis. And then on top of that, if we think about people-to-people exchanges, prior to the pandemic, every year China has been sending a lot of Chinese students to study in America. And Wisconsin is actually one of the top destinations for Chinese students to study in America.
This has been controversial, though, since we went from zero trade with China, more or less, in the early 1970s to opening of trade ties. Can you talk about the benefits we've seen in the U.S., especially in terms of cheaper stuff, and the costs, especially in terms of losing factories in some cases?
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of the benefit, right, trading with China, there are the goods, the bads, and the ugly. So let's start with the goods. I think from a consumer's perspective, the most significant benefit would be cheaper imported goods from China, from toys to TVs or computers or cell phones assembled in China. And then secondly, trading with China also created a lot of jobs in America, specifically from the perspective of not necessarily lost manufacturing jobs, but jobs in the service industry as well. And then thirdly, by trading with China, the added benefit is that the liberal, especially from the liberal political perspective, by influencing Chinese middle class, by interacting with Chinese consumers, we are hoping that America's way of life, America's ideas might influence the Chinese people, and then change China from a relatively authoritarian regime to a more open political system. And then on the more controversial aspect of it, especially on the trade part, we have roughly speaking five primary areas of a concern. The top of which, especially we read in the headlines these days, would be national security. And that's to start with, you know, our cell phones or social media platforms being influenced by Chinese government or controlled by Chinese government or subject to espionage and things like that. So that's national security. And then secondly, there is also the concerns about the China's unfair trade behavior or unfair trade practices that might have hurt American businesses and American interests. And then thirdly, there is the concern of job losses. The idea is China has comparative advantage in terms of producing relatively low cost goods, and that might replace a lot of manufacturing jobs here in the United States. And then fourthly, the concern would be related to environmental concerns from the perspective of the use of relatively poisonous materials or the damage to the environment. And the last but not least, there is also the concern with regard to labor rights. And a lot of these have been played out, especially in the context of Xinjiang Uyghurs and the treatment of prison laborers.
I want to get to one of those things you mentioned as a possible upside, the idea that increased trade, increased market economy was going to make the Chinese government hopefully less authoritarian. I think there's concern that with the current administration regime there, that's not happening, that Chinese authoritarian leaders have figured out how to make that not happen.
You know, Rob, I think you nailed it just now. And the idea of economic interdependence would prevent countries to go to war, and year after year we might be able to convert the other countries more like us. That's a kind of very genuine and very very missionary idea of America, of us here, right? And in many ways, I would say China has changed, and the Chinese consumers have been looking up to America and American way of life. You know, just by looking at the numbers of Chinese students who came to study in America and want to stay here, right? So I think that's a very positive sign. But then on the other hand, when from the ruler, from the leader's perspective, if the population inside or the citizens of a country started to have different ideas than what you tend to want them to have, that may not necessarily be a comforting sign. So I would say right now, what is facing American policymakers right now is not necessarily the Chinese consumers or the Chinese citizen that matter Chinese middle class, but really is the leadership, the Communist Party's leadership.
Talking to Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the U.S. dependency on production and trade in China. A lot of political concerns, security concerns, but a lot of interconnectedness between the economies of the two nations. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have U.S.-China trade relations impacted your life, your income at all over the years? Would you like to see the U.S. move away from producing things in China, buying things from China? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the future of U.S.-China trade relations. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, what you've seen maybe in your own career, your own business. Do you rely on selling stuff, agricultural products, say, to China? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alan is with us in Kenosha. Alan, hi.
Hey, and thank you for having me on. It's all, when you're dealing with China, it's all about your name. And you need to know where your name is and where you live. And I think we really need to recognize that people in Shanghai, Taiwan, that these are our current economic trends within the larger administration. The holdover, nobody wants to be part of the CCP elite, and I think that's where a lot of this is going for right now.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. He mentioned Shanghai, Taiwan, of course, a separate country, unless, of course, you ask the leaders of mainland China. But Alan, making a point that I think you were getting at, Zoe, that we might be trading with elements, with business groups in China, and that's not the same thing, Alan says, as supporting the Chinese Communist Party, the current regime in China.
I think what Alan made a great point there, recognizing that actually China is a very heterogeneous country, and where you live actually determines your interest. So from that perspective, it's very much similar to here in the United States. Like, for example, if China wanted to open up and practice free trade, a lot of these major cities on the ocean area is going to be very happy. For example, like Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Shanghai benefited tremendously from trading with the United States, but less so for the inland area. So I think Alan made a great point there.
Thanks for the call, Alan. Gary joins us now in Ripon. Gary, hi.
Hello. I think there's a certain falseness even in referring to this as trade, since the great, great preponderance of the money is going all one way and not so much the other. I mean, we're funding communist China to a much tremendously greater degree than they fund us.
Gary, thanks for the call. And Zoe, Gary hitting on a concern from many in the U.S. that the trade, there's a gap, a deficit, more money flowing out to China than into the United States.
You know, Gary, that is a very interesting observation you made there. And I have to say, yes, you actually touched upon the issue of what we would say, economists would refer to that as a trade deficit. The idea is we are buying more Chinese goods than the Chinese are buying from us. But the other side of the trade deficit is the so-called foreign exchange reserves that are being accumulated by the Chinese central bank. And because of the nature of the Chinese system and the relatively lack of sophisticated financial market, China, or for that matter, the Chinese People's Bank of China, the central bank, it had limited options, but had to invest in U.S. treasuries. In other words, actually right now, what we are seeing is China has been the largest U.S. treasury holders for quite some time. So from that matter, we are, by running a larger trade deficit with China, we are also sort of hijacking China to invest in U.S. treasuries.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Mike joins us now in the Fox River Valley. Mike, hello.
Hi. Wisconsin had a thriving paper and printing industry that up until sometime in the mid-90s, all the printing that I see now, publications, magazines, some of the large books are all printed in China, and it breaks my heart because cities like Wisconsin Rapids and Wausau and Appleton, there was a lot of lost jobs in the paper industry, and those were very high-paying, well jobs in the printing industry. Was also something that surrounding states like Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois didn't lose as much as Wisconsin did.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike hits on, I think, a big concern that in certain communities and certain industries, we had a very concentrated negative impact from opening up trade with China, including printing here in Wisconsin, Zoe.
Yes, absolutely. And Mike's point with regard to printing and paper industry, I think that's a good example. Another good example that might have suffered from, especially from the trade war with China, is the ginseng growing industry in Wisconsin. I grew up in China, and a lot of my relatives there are major consumers of Wisconsin ginseng. And but after trade war, they recognized that in order to buy ginseng tea made from Wisconsin, the price increased by more than a half. So from that perspective, the trade war with China is hurting our communities in Wisconsin, but it's also hurting the Chinese consumers.
Thanks for that call. So I want to take our last couple of minutes to look at the alternatives. If the American political system decides, yes, we want to extricate ourselves from this much trade with China, what could that look like? What kind of options would be on the table to say we're going to buy fewer microchips and printed goods, and the list goes on and on from China.
Oh yeah, that's a great mental exercise. But I would have to take a step back and say, if we were leaving a complete, if we were heading towards a complete trade decoupling with China, we are going to see, you know, whenever you go to, we go to the grocery store, we are going to have to pay a lot more. For our whatever we are buying now, and then on top of that, we probably will couple that with inflationary pressure. We're probably a lot of our middle class people here in the United States are going to suffer, not because of our diminished relationship with China, but also simply from the price pressure perspective. And then on the other hand, I do not think fully decoupling with China is going to be easily achieved. And if we just take the supply chain divorce these days, you know, dominant headline, for example, I would argue that a complete supply chain divorce from China would be extremely difficult, and it would not happen overnight. Take, you know, the iPhone, for example. Like right now, about 98% of iPhones have been assembled in China, and that is the result of more than two decades of effort that Apple has been putting in their building supply chains in China. And if Apple were to remove their productions to China, it's probably going to take them about by 2030, Apple would at most move 10% of their production capacity out of China. So from that perspective, I do not think decoupling is going to happen anytime soon.
Zoe, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob, and thank you for our audience.
That was Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us today to talk about the future of U.S.-China trade relations. Wisconsin's population is aging. State estimates show that almost a quarter of residents will be 65 or older by 2040. Helping people stay mobile as they age is critical to help them maintain their quality of life and independence. But local public transit agencies and nonprofits are already struggling to do that. Jonah Chester reports.
It's a warm October day in Green Bay, and Kathy Koch has a dentist appointment to get to.
All right.
Hold it right there, and I'll come on the other side.
Okay, sounds good.
Koch is 79 and has lived in the same home for more than half a century. She relies on a walker to get around, and she can't drive herself to the office.
My husband's been dead for a while, so to ask the children, it's difficult. They all work. The grandchildren all work.
Koch relies on an organization called Curative Connections. The Green Bay nonprofit provides services, including transportation, to the elderly and people with disabilities. As the driver helps her out of the van, she says Curative is also a connection to her community.
Oh, I love the human contact.
It's very important.
It doesn't happen very often. I'm going to let you get the bill.
People over 65 are becoming a larger and larger portion of Wisconsin's population. That means more people will rely on specialized transportation to stay mobile. But without more support, Wisconsin's paratransit systems may not be ready to support the state's aging population. Like other states, Wisconsin received transportation funding through federal infrastructure and COVID aid bills. Green Bay Metro Transit Director Patty Kiewiz says that money was helpful, but wasn't a permanent fix.
So I think the next few years here will be, you know, in a much better position than we have been. But, you know, that's also something you need to be careful of, is that's really kind of one-time money. Then what are we going to do in a couple, you know, in 3 years?
That's a multi-million dollar question. The largest source of state funding to improve transit for the elderly and disabled hasn't risen in years. And other state transit spending fell to its lowest level in more than a decade last year. Green Bay Metro has coped with declining funds by cutting and consolidating bus routes and paratransit services. They're trying to fill the gaps with a local ride-hailing app. Organizations like Curative Connections are trying to patch the remaining cracks in the system, but they're also facing the economic challenges of inflation and higher gas prices. Curative's transportation director, Tina Wietung, says they've also lost about half of their volunteer drivers since the beginning of the pandemic, and they can't afford to replace all of them with paid drivers.
We've had to limit the number of rides based on volunteer and driver availability. So we're down probably 30% compared to prior years before COVID.
Advocates say on-demand services like Curative are important, but still imperfect. Tamara Jackson co-chairs the Non-Driver Advisory Committee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She says many paratransit resources are concentrated in urban areas.
Public transit often ends at jurisdictional boundaries. So a lot of times, even if there is public transit available, you know, it might end at the county line or the city line.
Even within those jurisdictions, there can be gaps.
Public transit simply isn't everywhere where people need to go.
Changing that would mean a significant shift in how local and state officials design their services. So what's the solution?
This is both a funding and a structural puzzle to solve.
Denise Jess is another co-chair of the Non-Driver Advisory Committee. Jess is also legally blind and a non-driver, so she's experienced many of the barriers she's trying to address.
My invitation is that the state legislature really comes to the table and works with us on this very complex transportation problem that we face in this state.
Governor Tony Evers and state legislators will have the chance to do that when work on the next state budget begins in February. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.